Three, two, one. Hey, Randy.
How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing all right. What's going on?
Well, this week we are going to talk about one of my favorite subjects. It's a strangely unknown leg of research being done to harvest energy from our environment.
I was not aware that energy harvesting was unknown, although they don't really have in these applications that you sent me or in these papers that you sent me any really strong devices. And some of these are 2014 or something. But, you know, I've been thinking about this since at least 2005 and probably a couple years earlier. I mean, it's something that's been out there for quite a long time. And I don't think anybody at this point, at least anybody in the scientific community, in the material science community, probably applied physics, I don't think anybody's unaware of it.
You mean stochastic resonance energy harvesting, what we're going to talk about this time?
Energy harvesting in this sort of way. I'm not completely sure what they mean by stochastic resonance here. A lot of the experiments that I saw in these are much more planned than the things that I remember people talking about. So what people really want is to have something where they can just have it sit around and the thermal energy is going to play around with the system. It's going to vibrate things and so forth and so on. You'll get these random thermal fluctuations and you can use these random thermal fluctuations somehow in your system to turn it into a small electric current.
Yeah, I see a lot of research being done on thermionic energy harvesting where they have a temperature gradient. And you can put things on a car engine or on some kind of furnace, like an industrial furnace or something, and get energy out of that. But that's not terribly convenient. I suppose you can get a little trickle charge by placing one side on your body because it's a little bit warmer than the air on the other side. And so they can harvest a tiny, tiny bit of energy that way. But what I find really exciting about this subject, stochastic resonance energy harvesting, is that it's a method by which you can get electrical current from vibrations that aren't at any specific frequency, that they're broadband, so they're noise, they're random. And what I never heard of before was the principle of stochastic resonance, where you can have what they call a bistable system, which I guess is like a sort of like a pendulum that has two minimums of energy instead of just one. Like there's got to be like a barrier between two low energy states. And if you pump a certain frequency of signal to kind of drive the pendulum over that barrier in the middle, then you can take ambient vibrations and turn them into useful energy much more so than you could ever do with a linear oscillator, which, you know, we're all familiar with. I think that I've seen things like devices where they planned on putting plates down on your car floorboard, for example. And these would be kind of tuned to oscillate up and down from all the bumps that your car goes over and get a little bit of current out of that. Those have to be tuned to basically the resonant frequency. And that really limits their utility because, you know, there's fast vibrations and slow vibrations. Stochastic resonance energy harvesting lets you tap into a much larger pool of vibrations and get energy out of it sort of no matter what frequency you're at, you know, it's averaging at in a certain bandwidth. So I think it's really an exciting way to get energy out of the environment, partly for reasons that we'll talk about a little bit further on. Well, we'll get into the more theoretical stuff. Let's talk a little bit about how it works. We looked at three different papers to prepare for this podcast. You want me to just read them off so people can know what we're talking about?
Yeah, you can give the names if you'd like.
Okay, so we're looking at a paper called Bistable Vibration Energy Harvesters, a Review from 2012. And that was pretty widely cited by like 137 citations. And then there was another paper, a review of the recent research on vibration energy harvesting via bistable systems from 2013, which is very highly cited. And then there was a more recent one in 2014 called An Application of Stochastic Resonance for Energy Harvesting in Bistable Vibrating Systems.
Okay, and I guess in this particular case, or in all three cases, we're looking at bistable systems. That is in contrast to what they were calling a monostable Duffing oscillator and an impact harvesting. So both of those are different kinds of energy harvesting devices. And what the big difference here is that double well potential. And that double well potential, it's something that I've seen used quite a lot. It's something that they use especially in sort of an effective field theory, to describe something like magnetism or anything with an order parameter, because it's very good for showing how you can have a phase transition. And so you can show how when you change that height of the barrier between the two states, what actually happens. So let me talk about a system with two states. Is that all right? A fairly simple system with two states is, say, a buckled piece of metal. You push transverse along that piece of metal, and it's going to push out. So you have like a long cantilever. You push down on the ends, and then it's going to push out in the middle perpendicular to the way you're actually pushing as you change the size.
Right, it's going to kind of bow.
And it'll bow basically in one or the other direction, and it doesn't really care too much which one it's in. Either one is a perfectly fine spot to be in. And in fact, being perfectly straight is also an equilibrium. It's just an unstable equilibrium. So what's going to happen when you're pressing down is that it's going to stay in that state until it no longer can, for whatever reason, which could be any sort of asymmetry in the system, which could be coming from the metal, it could be coming from the way you're applying the pressure, and could be coming from geometry considerations, it could be coming from a little burst of wind. But somehow there's some reason for it to push off in one direction or the other. So even after you develop these double wells or these two stable states, which are bowing one side and bowing the other side, it is possible to stay in that center thing right on top of that double well. There's a spot right in the middle, which is where that barrier is. And then there are amounts of bowing on either side, how big this little bulge is. And those stable spots where we're talking about that bulge, those are the bottoms of the potential energy well. That's where the potential energy is least in this system after you've applied the force. And then after you've got there, you know, you can move it around a little bit, but it'll always come back to that bowed shape unless you push it far enough that it goes over that hump, and then it'll bow in the other direction and you have the same thing going on. And we're all familiar with that. I think we're all quite familiar with that. It's so familiar that I gave a lecture on potential energy and equilibria, and this was one of my examples. So most of the real potential energy solutions that you have in Physics 1 class are really just single minima states. But I use this model to show one model where you had a potential energy with multiple states. Or you had a potential energy with multiple stable states. And that just happened to occur this week. So this is something that's quite interesting. Well, also, last week,
synchronicity is strong in this one.
So anyways, that's the double well potential. And then what happens is you add some sort of kinetic energy in there. If you have a kinetic energy that's, I guess, smaller than that energy barrier, you get orbits in one of those potential wells. So you can get small vibrations in the bowing. So if you now sort of move your buckled piece of metal around, then as the metal tries to keep up, that amount of bowing is going to change just a little bit, but it's going to stay near that center. It's not going to flip from one side to the other.
Right. In these papers, they call that an intra-well oscillation, right?
That's right. So that's the intra-well oscillation. You're staying inside one of these potential wells. You're staying near one stable state. But then if you were to do this really fast with a high frequency or with a high amplitude, what would happen? Well, now all of a sudden you have a lot of kinetic energy that you're associating with this thing. And every time you change direction, the buckled piece of metal will snap from one direction to the other one, just like if you'd pressed it. And it will snap, 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 snap. And that's another kind of oscillation. That was the interwell oscillation, I think they called it, right?
Right, and that's where they found that they can get a lot of energy out of this system.
And then if they got really, really close to the energy near the transition, they had a lot of chaotic stuff going on. They actually had a bifurcation there, and then that's where chaotic dynamics shows up. If you really wanted some chaos.
Right, and sometimes you just gotta have it. So let's talk about...
There was a punk band called The Exploited. I guess their only real hit was Don't Forget the Chaos.
That's a great name. They should have been physicists. All right, so let's talk about how you get energy out of this thing. How does a bistable resonator built like the actually there's actually one of a device is one of the examples they show here, which is a lot like the buckled cantilever that you're talking about, And they design a device around that to harness ambient vibrations across a broad spectrum.
Okay, is this the one from the applications paper?
Let me think.
The one where they've got the large table setting up the random vibrations?
Well, that was a really, really elegant experiment. And I think that what they used there was a little bit different. It had a cantilever with a magnet on one end that was in opposition to a magnet mounted a few centimeters away from it so that it would never hang out in the center in its rest position. So it would always bow up or bow down. And then they used a little electromagnet below to drive it up and down as an excitation signal. But I think it might have been in the bistable vibration. Let me see here. I think it was in the bistable vibration energy harvesters review where they talked about the cantilevered.
Yeah, that one had several different experimental setups that they showed.
Right.
All hand-drawn.
Right. They're pretty rough, too. But the cantilever that you're talking about does appear in that paper. It's figure 6A.
Okay, figure 6A. Yeah, they have something very similar to that there. And unfortunately, I'm not completely sure with these particular ones how they went, because they had at most a paragraph on each one. It was pretty quick. So can you tell me how you understood figure 6A? This is an example of what they were calling mechanical bistability, the buckled beam, the cantilever. Here they had to have a piezoelectric something or other actually picking up the energy. But I'm not really sure what was doing the driving. Do you know what exactly was doing the driving?
Well, I know that they put a proof mass in the middle. I'm not sure. I guess to give it enough inertia to help snap it through to the other side. They didn't talk in specifics about how to drive that. But if you had any kind of actuator or something attached to it that would force it back and forth with a little bit of energy to kind of get it close to the level of energy it would take to snap through to the other side, then when you expose that system to random noise, sometimes it'll coincide with that excitation just the right time to snap it through. And if you get everything tuned just right, you can make it snap back and forth up and down constantly, and then your PZT will pick up the strain from the metal bending its shape and induce a current that you, an AC current that you can harvest the energy that
way. Yeah, you can get something like that. Unfortunately, they don't go into too much detail on this particular paper about, you know, how and why that was working. I assume it's in the same vein as in the application paper with the magnets, because there, at least, I understood exactly what was going on, because, you know, this was just about that one application. In that particular case, you have a cantilever, but you don't have it strained or anything like that. And you have a driving frequency and a vibration generator.
In the application of stochastic resonance for energy harvesting paper, we're looking at figure 7, which is really a beautifully drawn illustration. You can see exactly how it's working.
They're vibrating the whole table up and down with white noise. And while they're doing that, they have an AC current driving an electromagnet. And that AC current is basically trying to oscillate that cantilever. So you have an electromagnet that's, say, midway through the beam, under the beam, midway through it, that's pulling and pushing a magnet that's midway through the beam. And then you have another magnet that's at the end that's interacting with two magnets at the end that just basically wants to attract to one or the other and not go to the middle.
Right. They got a magnetic bistability set up there through the magnetic repulsion. So the cantilever will either be at rest in the lower position or in the upper position, but not in the middle. And so that signal gives it a little bit of help on top of the noise below it, so that it can snap back and forth. And they did a terrific experiment within the really highly detailed analysis of how they did this.
Yeah, it was not really too strange what happened. You know, they have two forcing terms here on the cantilever. One forcing term is the random forcing term, which is a little bit like what you'd get from temperature. If you had just something sitting around in the air that was small enough, you'd notice it being bumped by, you know, air molecules and things like that, and basically just interacting with things because of the temperature. You'd get those sorts of random vibrations. And then you have this driving field that's going at a particular frequency. What would happen is that when the period of the stimulus, the period of the AC oscillations in the electromagnet, was equal to twice the waiting time, the time it would take the cantilever to swipe from pointing at one magnet to pointing at the other magnet, when it was twice that, then the random vibrations would sort of allow that transition to happen.
Okay, and that's with the Kramer frequency, right?
So yeah, there was something they called the Kramer rate, and that looks like a normal sort of Arrhenius kind of thing. That's comparing the size of the energy well to some number that they didn't really talk about, but which is probably this average size of the oscillations in the vibration table, because that's where you'd normally have the temperature in physical kinetics or something like that. So that ratio is, the exponential of that ratio is multiplied by an attempt frequency, and that gives you the Kramer's rate. Kramer's rate is one, yeah, that's one over the time it takes to go from one to the other. So that Kramer's rate is one over the waiting time.
Oh, okay. I thought the Kramer's rate was the frequency you needed to put that little oscillator to drive the system. But it's twice the Kramer's rate, huh?
It's half the Kramer's rate, because the Kramer's rate is the time to go from one well. And so the Kramer's rate would be one over that time. And so that's one half the frequency for the stimulus.
Okay, it's the inverse, okay.
And that's, I guess, where the upconversion is, or whatever it is that they keep talking about and they don't really explain very well.
Yeah, there was only one case where I really understood the upconversion process, and we'll talk about that soon. That's a different example. But one of the things that I love about this field is that there's so many different designs, and I don't think we've even really begun to see the full breadth of ways to design systems to be bistable so that you can harvest energy from them. These are all very mechanistic and very crude, kind of just to show the principle. And there's so many different ways to get there, you know, between the boat cantilever and then these different kinds of cantilevered levers with magnets. And, you know, I think that there may be other ways to do it at like a molecular level that haven't even been explored yet.
I'm sure there are. I mean, I think the reasons why people want to use these right now, you know, they're looking at these and they don't really give you a lot of energy and stuff like that. But what they'd really like to do is put these on microelectromechanical devices. They add another application here, but I think the big one is microelectromechanical devices. With microelectromechanical devices, what you want is to have some sort of power source to power your microelectromechanical device, which isn't some 1 foot by 2 foot by 3 foot power supply or something like that.
Right, something you can fit inside your cell phone, maybe.
So you don't want a big battery. You don't want anything that you can really see very well. You want something that's, you know, no bigger than 1/10 of a millimeter. You'd really like your microelectromechanical device to be 100 micrometers or smaller in size, because otherwise, what is it? Right, it's really a milli-electromechanical device or something like that.
So they're just working out like the operating principles at a macro scale so that they can optimize and learn how to do it at a really tiny scale.
I think so, because I mean, when they're talking about what they want to do with this, they say, well, we want to get MEMS power in milliwatt or microwatt range and all that other fun stuff. And then they have this thing that sits on a giant table that vibrates up and down. You would really prefer to have something that's very small that operated off of thermal energy. But you start with what you start with, right? Like you were saying previously, you have something that's on the bottom of a car. It vibrates up and down. That gives you some power. That's perfectly fine. You're perfectly happy to get that power back, right? You know, and increase the efficiency of your engine by using some of these effects. I mean, ideally, you'd be able to actually pull energy out of the air, because there's a lot of energy just sitting around in temperature that's very difficult to grab. There aren't very many ways to grab it right now.
Yeah, that's what I really love about this entire field of energy harvesting, is that it really wakes you up to the reality that we are bathed in energy all the time, and all, especially in the form of temperature, you know, of oscillations in the matter all around us, in the air, in water. These are our first baby steps sort of into learning how to access that energy, which is ambient. And so, you know, you won't need batteries anymore if you can really harness that heat energy.
Yeah. So they've got, what, 5 different types of things that they were talking about in this paper that you could use? They said you could harness solar energy, although I think that's probably just solar cells. I don't see that they're going to get anything better than that with this sort of technology. Maybe they can. There's thermal energy. There's vibrational energy that we've talked about as well. Also, they talked about wind. I guess that might be impact sort of stuff. And salinity gradients. They didn't really explain that one at all. But still, I mean, there are things like that out there that you can use to power things, which is fairly useful, I guess, and probably will be very important in the future.
Yeah, there was a mention in one of these papers about like a windmill style design where there was like a circular array. So I guess it was a multi-stable system. And apparently that allowed you to produce a wind turbine that would generate more energy and work at lower wind speeds than an ordinary wind turbine.
Yeah, there are plenty of ways that they can improve things. I mean, most mechanical things have such low efficiencies that there are multitudes of ways that you can improve them.
That's sort of the direction that I wanted to go with this conversation, was that if we combine this kind of thinking, and one of the reasons this is so exciting to people is because this stochastic resonance energy harvesting, and here in this one paper, the application paper, they found that they could get 4.6 times as much useful profit energy out of running the system than they could get with a linear oscillator. And there's other talk in other papers about getting an order of magnitude more energy from this kind of system than an ordinary linear oscillator. It's a really big step up. If we were to look at this from the viewpoint of phononics and metamaterials and get this down to like a molecular level where you could access thermal vibrations, holy cow, you know what I mean? There's so much energy in our environment. If you can tap into even 1% of it, then you've got a lot of useful power. Between phononics and metamaterials, we may be able to focus and harness and create the kind of function, oscillation function, that would drive a device like this, right? If we can work that out, all we need is a room temperature atmosphere, and you've got energy running your device, you know, or any number of devices. But see, this is where I get confused, is I was always taught in school that the second law of thermodynamics prevented us from harnessing these ambient energies. The idea was that, well, you know, the temperature in the atmosphere and in the water and everything, that's in like an entropy equilibrium, and you can't get energy out of it. Well, this kind of system seems to be proving otherwise. They put a little bit of energy in to create that excitation of the system, and then they end up getting, you know, several times more energy out from the entropic noise vibrations. How do we square that? I mean, was I just taught wrong?
I think in general that's true. I think what you're looking at are some very specific setups. And you've just found ways to pull a little bit of energy, a little bit of this thermal energy out, and make it do something useful. It's a little bit difficult in these larger things. It's hard for me to understand exactly how that's happened. When I first heard about these things, when I first was thinking about them, I was thinking about these as something you can do at the nanoscale. At that point, all of a sudden, thermodynamically, things don't make so much sense. You don't have to be as clever to figure out how to get a little bit of energy out of these things, because now all of a sudden you're dealing with these random fluctuations being large percentages of the energy of the system. In this case, at least, what you're looking at here is not, when you're looking at these large things that they're showing, you're not looking at heat. What you're looking at are these large vibrations. So in a sense, what they're saying is, if you take a big magnet and put it on a rail, and then you wait for an earthquake, during the earthquake, you'll be able to get a current out. That makes a lot of sense. All you have to do is realize that there's more to this system than just the magnet that's on a rail. Instead, there's also this giant earthquake that's happening. Again, with a nanoscale thing, if you're trying to use a nanoscale thing to harvest thermal vibrations, then the random fluctuations are relatively the same size as an earthquake. When they put this machine on a giant vibration table, the oscillations of the vibration table are reasonably large compared to the machine. So yes, you can get some amount of energy out of it. And I'm sure they're going to improve on this, but even at this resonance, they're getting about 1.8 watts of power out as compared to about 0.61, one-third, when they just have that AC oscillator on and not the vibration table. So they're still not getting huge amounts of power comparatively to what they're putting in, but they are getting a reasonable return on investment. I guess that's a strange way to put it.
No, that's right. I mean, it's energy instead of money. But in one of the things they even mentioned in one of these papers is that stochastic resonance has been used as a model to explain like financial systems and things.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was originally used
for the Earth.
It was originally used for plate tectonics or something like that?
It was the Ice Ages.
Oh, it was originally used for the Ice Ages. Yeah, so it did not go into an engineering field. So these were, I think, from sort of engineering journals mostly. The Journal of Sound and Vibration. I have absolutely no idea what that is. It's an LSVA journal. Yeah, so, I mean, this was not originally an engineering topic. Instead, it was, geology, and then they did some stuff with markets. But this is exactly the sort of thing that economists love to do, is put random vibrations onto something and see what happens on their linear model. It works perfectly well. At resonance, you get something interesting happen, right? That's what resonance is all about. And then the trick is how to get that energy out, especially in that thermal system that I was talking about. How do you get that energy out? Because you might be getting a nice oscillation now, or you might be able to get a nice oscillation from one of many coupled oscillators, because you might need many of these nanoscale coupled oscillators to get a nanowatt or power or something, whatever you need for your MEMS device. Right now, they still need those low milliwatt, high microwatt, but eventually they'll get less. You might need lots of these oscillators. But if you have one oscillator with your, you know, picowatt of current or whatever, that's not too amazing. But put 1,000 of those together, what you want to do is not have them all be out of phase and cancel each other out. So you have to be able to do something so that you actually get something reasonable out of that small system when you go to that thermal regime.
That's why I'm wondering about some of the things that we looked at with metamaterials and phononics, about how you can rectify phases in ambient noise environments, and you can create like a thermal diode so that the energy will move in a certain direction only. You know, it's like, wow, if we can engineer a material that will sort of rectify all these random vibrations into a useful form to drive a system like this, you know, then we've got something.
Yeah, I think the thing is you have to get a rectifier. You have to turn it into a DC instead of an AC current. Just keep the positive and eliminate the negative, right? I guess accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. I forgot that song.
I didn't know that was a song. So if we could do this, if we could get bring these different fields together, and one of the things that's great about this stochastic resonance energy harvesting field is that it has been drawing on a lot of different specialists in lots of different fields, is that if they could get together with the metamaterials engineers and the phononics experts in order to make the thermal fluctuations useful to driving an energy harvesting device like this, then I guess what you'd get is a device that would turn ambient heat energy directly into electricity, so it would cool down, right? It would take heat out of the environment.
I expect that would happen. You'd reduce the amount of thermal energy in the environment.
Talk about killing two birds with one stone. I mean, global warming is like our greatest crisis right now.
If you're going to find a way to fix it, that would be my favorite way.
Yeah, I'm just imagining sheets of some kind of nanomaterial in these giant towers that we put around our cities around the equator, and we could start pulling the heat out of the atmosphere and turning it into electricity. I mean, it sounds like science fiction, but, you know, it's starting to look like that might be possible one day.
Yeah, well, maybe. But, yeah, let's find some patents and see what people have really done.
Yeah, we're a ways off yet, but I think I was looking at some phononic crystals and things like that, some other papers that got me thinking about this. Like, they're really getting down to the point where they're starting to explore, like, engineering at the molecular level to produce exactly those kind of effects, like channeling thermal energy into a specific direction and filtering out certain frequencies, and, you know, they're starting to do it.
Yeah, I think at some point they'll do it. I don't know if they'll ever have it working on a scale that they can do what you want it to do. Remember, whenever that power is actually used,
then it's going to release that heat back into the environment.
That's right. And probably because, you know, in all of these cases, you have to have a driving frequency or some kind. It's going to be more heat in the long run than you have just for the one case, right? So I get power out, but I also have to put power in to get the power out. So all that stuff gets used, that all turns into heat. In the end, you probably don't end up with the problem of figuring out how to get the glaciers off your power plants.
Still, I would give my right arm for an air conditioner that I could plug my hair dryer into.
Okay, well, there you go.
You know, instead of costing me 500 watts of energy to run my air conditioner, I could just plug things into it.
That might be nice. Yeah. And yeah, you can funnel all the grease from the Taco Bell into your car and everything will be good.
Wait, what are you talking about?
There was a guy at one point who'd built a car that would run off of sort of greasy, nasty crap that comes out of a fast food restaurant.
Oh, let me guess. The lifespan of the car was reduced by 80%. Its arteries clogged up and seized up.
I'm not sure exactly how he built it. It's something I just remember from the ancient days of yore, and it was mostly just, you know, one of these stunts. You know, he built something that really didn't work really well, probably smelt like cow farts when he drove it.
He was the least popular guy in the neighborhood.
I mean, I think he built it to prove a point, which is, you know, sort of a biodiesel-y sort of point or something like
sure.
that. Sure. Which is perfectly fine.
It's a hilarious idea. Why not?
Now I've got to figure out if that really happened or if it's just some strange thing in my memory.
Yeah, sometimes I mistake a really vivid, realistic dream for something that happens, and that can lead to pretty embarrassing fallout.
You know, at some point you don't really know what you remember.
I was just looking at these different papers here and seeing if there was anything else that we had missed that we should cover before we close out the show.
Oh, no, I think we got most of this stuff. I mean, unless you want to talk about, you know, the Duffing equation and stuff like that. I mean, it's very nice, but I don't think it's that interesting. And one of these had six analysis techniques, which, again, you know, it's very nice that you can use numerical integration, harmonic balance, the method of multiple scales, Melnikov's method, stochastic differential equation solutions, and signal decomposition to analyze these things. But I don't really know if that's really good radio.
Yeah, I read all that stuff and felt like falling asleep immediately. So I was like, maybe we shouldn't get too much into the math. So here is something that I did want to talk about, is you notice that on all of these experiments, these setups, they're using these piezoelectric transducers, I guess the kind that create electrical energy when they have a certain kind of strain. Is that the most efficient way to harvest energy out of the system? It seems odd. I mean, wouldn't you get more energy by, for example, having like a magnet extending from that vibrating cantilever that went into an inductive coil and getting it just directly through the electromagnetic induction?
Well, for a lot of these, if you're trying to do a proof of principle, you want to avoid that, because if you're using a moving magnet, that's going to be something that you have to prove that is not affecting what you're doing.
I see. There, because if you want to reduce it to just first principles, that adds an extra level of obscurity.
Well, I mean, on top of that, if you've got an electromagnet like they had in at least one of these, which I think they have in several of the different designs that we didn't talk about, if you have an electromagnet running,
yeah,
and you have a magnetic coil that you're using to create a current through induction somewhere, that electromagnet is going to in some way affect that current. So you have to then prove to the reviewers that that's not where your pickup's coming from.
Okay, but in practical terms, wouldn't that be more efficient?
You'd have to look at exactly the size of these things. The size of these oscillations might not be. But I think the biggest reason is just because you don't need additional stuff on your device, right? Instead of requiring at least two additional parts, you just require one. Right, which is this piezoelectric strain transducer, which is perfectly good. It's very efficient. It goes directly into your electronic system, and obviously it isn't interacting with any other part of your device except for the thing that you care about, which is my cantilever changing? So you're getting it from the is my cantilever changing thing directly. And it's not, you know, one or two more steps out there. I mean, I think that's probably the best choice for something of this size. I mean, I'm not sure, but I think if you wanted to get that magnet to be really useful, you need some larger vibrations than they're probably getting. Yeah, so, I mean, to me, the thing is to try to figure out how to model each one of these things on a material.
Right, at a materials level where you're...
Oh, well, yeah, maybe not just a material, but, you know, maybe... think about how to model it in terms of a metamaterial, but you probably don't even need that. But just try to figure out how to get all of this on one wafer, on one chip that doesn't take 10,000 moves in a clean room to make.
Well, right. And at that scale, at that super small scale, you'd be talking about much higher frequencies, which would be more along the lines of a thermal frequency, right?
I think that the particular effect that I'd think about, I'm not sure if you can get something for the right frequency for it, but the particular effect I'd think about would be the superparamagnetic effect, because that is literally what happens to a small ferromagnet, where it's so small that the thermal vibrations keep making it switch from one polarization, you know, north up and south down, to another polarization, south up and north down. Thermal vibrations keep switching the magnetization of that. You know, it's called superparamagnetism because you have a bunch of these particles in something, and then it acts like a paramagnet with a really high susceptibility. Even though what it is it's a large number of very, very small ferromagnets that are just so small they have no recourse when they get hit with a little thermal vibration and they flip their magnetization.
What kind of scale does that happen on?
Very, very small. It depends on the material. The number that's in my brain is 12 nanometers, but I don't recall exactly why or for what material. But I think it's much larger for some ferromagnetic materials than that.
That's intriguing. I wonder what scale you can get that up to so that you could harness it you know, through some kind of, I don't know, electronically, you know, etched circuit or something, you know.
I think they can. I'm sure that they can. So that would mean it had to be at least 100 nanometers. I'm sure that they can make super paramagnetic particles on a wafer.
That's bloody fascinating. I was not familiar with super paramagnetism, and I didn't know that just ambient thermal vibrations were enough to switch the polarity like that. But holy cow. Yeah, that would be a fantastic way to get energy out of the environment.
I think that's probably the best idea. So the reason why I'm familiar with it is because of magnetic recording. It's a bad thing. You don't want to make something so small and with such a low coercivity or anisotropy, depending on what you're actually doing.
It demagnetizes from the ambient heat.
That's right. And there are lots of reasons why people worry about that. For a magnet, for a large magnet, yeah, for something reasonably large and thin, the demagnetization field is already enough to keep that from happening. But when you start making things in the nanoscale, you no longer have thousands of times the size and the lateral dimensions than for the thickness of the thin film. And then all of a sudden, that energy that's keeping the magnet stable becomes too small, and there's no real preferred direction anymore. Even though there is, it's not as strong, and the thermal effects just whack it all over the place.
Well, I'm going to have to do some research on super paramagnetism and see what's to be learned there. Thanks for the tip.
Something that's out there if you ever need a topic.
I'd also like to talk about time crystals sometime soon, because those have been in the news, and those are fascinating too.
Time crystals? Are these the things that they use on Star Trek so that they can go...
Time travel? So Doctor Who made his TARDIS out of? Time crystals are just crystals that oscillate in a very specific frequency, and apparently they can oscillate so they have the same structure at various intervals, right? In various intervals in time. So they're kind of like a clock, and they apparently could go on and on and on forever. And I'm intrigued by that, because if you've got a crystal which is shifting, which is oscillating its structure through time in a regular way, then it makes you wonder if there's some way we can use that to harness energy.
All right, so some things we want to think about talking about are thermionic energy harvesting, time crystals, and super paramagnetism.
Hell yeah.
Okay, those are all going on the list, Randy.
Thanks, Jim.
thanks for talking, and we can, I assume you're done?
Yep, we're all good.
All right, well then, thanks for talking, and we'll find something else that's amazing to talk about next week, all right?
Sounds great. Thanks, Jim.
Okay, bye now.